Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my guest co-host, Claude Barabay. And I think to start things out today, just to give everybody a quick reminder from our last live show where we discussed with Eagle One, who's been with us from day one, that he's going to be taking a few months off. He is still the official Midrats co-host, but he's going to be doing some things for the rest, or not the rest, but for most of the rest of the year that really doesn't open up his Sundays for us. So we're going to keep his seat warm with a series of guest hosts that I hope will be recognizable to a lot of people, because our guest host today, Claude, everybody who's a regular Midrats knows who Claude is. He's been a regular guest and has really been in the background, a critical part of Midrats from day one. So I'll go ahead and say thanks to Claude to kick that off from there. And for those that are with us live at this point, I would usually point you in the direction of the chat room. Maybe it's running today, but when I try to access it as host, it got some real funny kickbacks, so it might not be running today. As such, I always give the invitation, if people have some observations or points they'd like to make on the show, to put in the chat room, or if there are even some questions they want us to direct to our guests, that's a great place to put it. While that's not going on, I think most of the listeners here are probably in one way or another on Twitter. So if you'd like, you can DM me or even just at me on Twitter. I'll monitor during the course of the show at CDR Salamander, all one word. And I will do best to integrate your good ideas, if you have any, into the show. And now I want to get on with the show. But to kick it off, before I introduce our guest, standard disclaimer here for our guest. Our guest is speaking as an individual himself. He is not speaking for the institute of his employment or any other organizations he may be associated with now or in the future. Because what we're going to dive into today is we're going to talk about a nation's grand strategy, not just the means, the capability, the national will, or something we've discussed here on Midrats on a regular basis, the support of the American people to meet the demands from the global entanglement that our leadership and elected officials have signed our country up for over the course of the last few decades. And our guest to discuss this and perhaps other related topics will be Dr. David Geo. And we're going to use as a touching point today and maybe a kicking off point, is he published a recent article in the National Interest called Make America Strategic Again. You can find links to that over at my home blog and also on the show page if you haven't already read it. So we'll be using that as a foundation for our discussion going forward. Dr. Geo's background, he's an assistant professor of history at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point. That's also where he serves as history fellow for the Army Cyber Institute. He got his B.A. in History and Social Science from Wheaton College, an M.A. from Georgetown University School of Foreign Service, and he earned his Ph.D. in Politics and International Studies from the University of Cambridge. He retains his commission as a senior officer in the U.S. Naval Reserve, so it's always good to have additional spies up at West Point. And he is assigned to the Defense Intelligence Agency's Defense Attaché Service as a side gig. David, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you. It's great to be with you.
And we really appreciate you coming on, because this is a topic that we've tickled the fringes of a few times on Midrats during the course of the year. But one thing we've never really done is really dug into, for friends of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, the ultimate question. And that has to do with grand strategy. And I know especially as somebody who is helping to educate the future leaders of our military. You perhaps struggle with this for the beginnings, but even people who have been in the business for a long time misuse the term strategy, or perhaps unintentionally misassignment to other areas. It may be tactical or even operational. But even more than that, there is the grand strategy that we're going to talk about today. So it's kind of a scene setter. Define for the listeners what a grand strategy is and how it should be looked at.
Sure. If I can riff on war theorist Karl von Clausewitz, which I hope I won't do too much. But he said, in war, everything is simple, but even the most simple things are difficult. And I'd like to just sort of substitute strategy for war. Reformulated then, in strategy, everything is simple, but even the most simple thing is difficult. Because it doesn't sound hard. I think strategy is the simple question of, well, what is it that we want, usually in this case in the international system, and then what can we reasonably hope to achieve? How do we connect the ends and the means, and what are those resources at our disposal? And so I think that we get confused a lot of times because we start, and I think this is true about the U.S. I haven't read enough foreign strategy documents to make a sort of bolder claim. But I think in our strategy formulation, we get confused with identifying preferred end states and what we want to see, and then sort of make a tautology that, well, this is what we want to see, therefore this is what will be seen. It's not just the most recent national security strategy, although that certainly suffers from it, but it seems a little bit like, well, there's a lot of money in the world, and David Geo would like to be a billionaire. So with some hard work, David Geo will become a billionaire. And that this sort of logic, I think, it just sort of defies my grasp. And I don't understand why we can't sort of more explicitly link our ways and our ends and our means together. And I guess that's why it's both sort of simple. We need to get all of our levers of government, and I would include society in that basket, on the same page, and then figure out what it is that they're all trying to do in concert with one another. And so it seems that the real rub is trying to put strategy, translate that into practice in the real world.
Claude?
Thanks, Sal. And by the way, Sal, thanks for the opportunity to co-host today and fill in for Eagle One. I know that he is the ever genial co-host. I guess as a New Englander, that would make me the never genial co-host. But David, for you, the question is, the late historian Barbara Tuchman wrote that policy makers in the Capitol evolve a policy to fit the picture of what's in their heads rather than to fit the situation. And based on the research of your article and your other research, I was wondering if you thought that that is an accurate assessment with regard to how military strategy occurs.
It's hard to always sort of disagree with Barbara Tuchman, so I won't. I think that's largely correct. I think, though, that the problem is that the Pentagon sort of goes off and does its planning, and the policymaker pays attention when something explodes. Or something makes the news, or something demands their attention. And so you've got the military planners that sort of spend a lot of time thinking about, well, what if this and what if that? And they, of course, only control what they control, that is to say, you know, military resources. And the policymaker, I'm afraid to say, I just don't think that they even have a coherent understanding or a picture, to use your terms, of what they want in the world. And I'm reminded in your question of when about a year or so ago, we lost four Special Forces soldiers in, I think, Niger. And we had several congressmen and senators who were actually on the various oversight committees professing to have no idea that we actually had troops in these places. And what are they doing? And I need a briefing on that. And so, you know, I if they even gave it as much thought as Barbara Tuchman is giving them credit for, I think I'd be happy.
Thanks. Sal? Over to you, Sal. All right. He may be having some technical difficulties, David, so I'm going to go into my next question. In your piece that you wrote for the National Interest, you warn of tripwires where the United States will have decided the risks of catastrophic escalation are less than the benefits of deterrence. And under current conditions, can you see this occurring anywhere specifically? And how prepared are you? How prepared do you think we are strategically for those eventualities?
Yeah, thanks. It's a good question, and I guess I wrote the piece out of concern. I sort of do my best writing, I guess, when I get angry, and or at least I do my fastest writing when I get angry, and I can sort of hear myself pounding away on the keyboard. And I guess if should I just back up a minute and sort of explain why I put pen to paper, so to speak, in this in this piece. So about I guess maybe 6 or 7 months ago, in September, Polish President Andrzej Duda told President Trump that he would like to see permanent U.S. presence, combat presence, on Polish territory, and that and there was some sort of jesting maybe that it was going to be named Fort Trump, and so I thought this was a bad idea. There are already troops in Poland, by the way, and probably more on the way. And so I read a piece by two other scholars, and they basically said, well, this is a good idea, and this would be worthwhile. And you know, the U.S. should absolutely do this. And it seems to me to be almost like a anyone that's been through sort of a joint military operations or any sort of formal education in a war college, or anyone that's played risk or diplomacy, we'll just sort of put pieces here and pieces there, and oh well, they might get knocked off the board, but such is life. And I think that putting troops in Poland, well, in the piece as you mentioned, I list a whole bunch of reasons, but I think we've set a lot of tripwires for ourselves globally. So the Baltics, I think, can certainly be a tripwire. But I think also, the East China Sea, the South China Sea, the U.S. Navy is a big fan of doing freedom of navigation operations, not far from Taiwan. And, we're sort of always trying to keep Iran in the Gulf. And I get concerned that that if any one of those could go badly at any given time, and then I think that they would go quickly, that one might go badly and then another one might go badly. And we've got an all-volunteer force. And, our global ambition is larger than what our forces are prepared for, which leaves us to a question of, do we increase the size of the military to I've heard 377 ships, and everyone kind of throws out their preferred military size, or do we scale back our ambitions, and do we do that either through restraint, or do we do that through sort of offshore balancing, or will there be some magical technological offset that will come to save us? And so these are the questions that I think are facing us at the moment.
Thanks. Sal, back over to you.
Yeah, I'm glad that we already got to the point of talking about tripwires. And I think in the article that you also talked about skin in the game. And that is terminology that's used on a regular basis. And you drive home the fact that there's something actually very real behind that little theoretical buzzword of tripwires and skin in the game. But what we're talking about here is battalions of dead Americans in the first few days of a war, with the theory that with that happening, that the American public will respond as we always have, and people's human nature to respond that way, and would ramp up quickly. And it goes to the question of national will and the old cliche that about Prussia, that Prussia was a military that had a country, vice a country that has a military. Has anybody really tried to make an effort to educate the American public about a possible disconnect between the sacrifice and blood and treasure they would be willing to do on behalf of other people, vice the obligation that their leadership has signed their name to, as exemplified by these various tripwires and skin in the games that keep coming up?
Right. I'm always reminded, sort of sadly, by one of my favorite quotes by Mark Twain, although I think Churchill borrowed it, when he said that God created war so Americans would learn geography. And, you know, it's sort of one of those funny, not funny kinds of things, you know, funny because it's true, but maybe sad because it's true. And, you know, and I am concerned because, to my knowledge at least, and I'm certainly not an exhaustive source, but to my knowledge, no one, there's not been enough research that asks the American people, hey, are we, you know, if we get into a peer conflict or a near peer conflict, are we ready for that? Because certainly the active duty and the reserves and the guard would be employed, but as the in the piece, I mentioned a report from the U.S. Institute of Peace, and they note that if America gets into a conflict with one peer competitor, others aren't just going to sit on the sidelines. Others are going to take advantage of that situation, as any country would do, because we live in an anarchic system. And so, you know, I ask as many, you know, people as I can all the time when I'm not in the West Point context, you know, would you be ready to join up? Would you like to see your kid join up or your loved one join up? And the answer is almost invariably no. And I think we see this with the I don't want to call it a debate because it's not a debate, but if we were to have a debate about having a draft or some kind of national service, I think we would see that more, you know, more readily. And so Americans are largely sort of relatively bellicose, I think by nature, and that they've assigned to war in particular an agency or a utility where the historical record just simply doesn't bear out that going to war gets you what you want. For every example of war, resorting to war as the key element of your grand strategy, I can come up with a million other cases why it didn't work. And I think both Congress and the American people need to take their responsibilities of both governance and citizenship a little bit more seriously. And I'd like to give just one example of that. I don't know if you remember when Jay Leno used to do jaywalking, where he would ask average Americans, I don't know, on Hollywood Boulevard or wherever they were, you know, sort of really easy questions, and they would get it wrong. And it was a gag, you know, for late night television. But this happened in 2014 in real life. There was an extremely important study that you can actually look up in the monkey cage from the Washington Post, which is where the sort of précis of it exists. And this was right when Putin was getting involved in ultimately taking over Crimea. And they asked, these political scientists asked people, well, where is Ukraine and do you want to get involved? And 1 in 6 people was able to properly find the Ukraine on a map. And the average distance wrong was 1,800 miles. And so if you actually go to the Washington Post monkey cage site and you dig up the article, they have a map of where people think the Ukraine is. And it's sort of hilarious because it's in the Indian subcontinent. It's in the middle of various oceans. It's in Iceland. It's in Antarctica. It's in Australia. But here's why the study was so important is because the more wrong the respondents were about their interest in going about where Ukraine was, the more likely they were to want to get militarily involved. And so it's hard for us to see, to have that proper civ-mil relationship when at least the military knows where it is, at least the planners do, but the American people don't. And I think we need to sort of demand more, I guess. If on one hand, people like me are calling for a greater voice and more attention paid by foreign policy elites to average Americans, the average Americans also need to up their game and I think do a little bit more self-study about some of these really important issues, because they can be issues of life and death.
And David, we have a caller on a line I believe you may be familiar with, Jerry Hendricks. Jerry, you're on with David.
Good afternoon, and David, this has been a great conversation. I've got a question, which goes to sort of an underlying foundational issue of what you're talking about. During the Cold War, we actually had a strategic consensus and where people all came together and agreed on the idea of containment. But there was also a strategic culture in that both academic and business community, as well as the political class, all understood the strategy and could think as a group strategically. What steps we need to take to sort of offset this domestic left-right focus and get back to a strategic culture in our national conversation?
Thanks. It's a great question. You mentioned that. Well, the question is a huge one. I think there was a consensus until there wasn't. I think in the Cold War context, it may be that Vietnam looms largest because we had a consensus until there was such thing as a domino theory, and then there was such thing as a draft, and then people started saying, well, why is it that our young people are getting sent to South Vietnam, and does that have any bearing on U.S. national security? And when the answer was no, you'll recall President Nixon drew troops out in 1973, and sure enough, Saigon fell in 1975, but also sure enough, it sort of didn't matter on Main Street. And so the whole idea, of the consensus and we need to go sort of confront everyone everywhere and bear any burden and pay any price and support any group seeking freedom, we opted to do it in South Vietnam, much to our great regret, but we also opted not to do it as early as 1956 in Hungary, and then we opted again not to do it in 1968. In Czechoslovakia. And I think the reasons why were simply that it was understood that was their sort of sphere of the Soviet sphere of influence. And really, there's nothing that we could practically do aside from confronting the Soviets in Eastern Europe, which we weren't prepared to do. And when I think about the American people, as the history fellow for the Army Cyber Institute, I think a lot about the relationship between the government and Silicon Valley in particular, and I think we have this assumption that, well, in World War II, Detroit became the arsenal of democracy, and we got planes a bomber an hour or whatever it was. And we can make a liberty ship in a day. And so we think, oh, well, America has this amazing industrial base, and we'll go ahead and just sort of implicitly rely on this. And of course, in 2019, a lot of the industrial base is silicon-based, and it's technology companies. And a couple of examples quickly come to mind. The first one, and both of these are recent, the first one is when Google told the Department of Defense it didn't want anything to do with Project Maven, which was an artificial intelligence contract to assess drone footage. And the Googlers who objected to it, they did it on the grounds that it quote, damaged Google's brand and hurt its ability to compete for talent, unquote. And it also didn't want Google, quote, being in the business of war, unquote. And we see this with Microsoft as well, when they wanted to cancel a contract to supply augmented reality headsets to the Department of Defense because it would, quote, help people kill. And so the Microsoft employees, quote, wanted to cease developing any and all weapons technologies for the government, unquote. And so I don't know that there's a consensus to be had, I'm afraid to say. And so that's why I think before we try to push anyone in a, you know, any our citizenry in a specific direction, I think we need to really reexamine our assumptions about the levels of domestic support for what the military may do and what the policymaker is going to call on the military to do. That's a great question. I'll sort of stop there.
Claude?
David, I'd like to follow up on that in a previous answer that you gave about the monkey cage and how individuals were identifying Ukraine 1,000 miles away. And the further away you were, that the more likely they were to support something militarily. And it struck me because I'm reading this bio of Benjamin Franklin by Walter Isaacson, and in it, Franklin has distrust both the aristocrats and the uninformed mob. Do you think that policymakers should include public polls, if you will, in their calculus? And as a second part of that, do you think the reason why it's easier for folks to automatically go to military options is because there's not a better imagery to use to sell for economic or diplomatic aspects of strategy? For example, it's easier, people can conceptualize bombs on target. They can see a ship firing a gun or a missile. It's probably less familiar to see something as succinct in terms of economic or diplomatic aspects of strategy. I was wondering if you could just comment on that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm reminded of the book "How Everything Became War and War." How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything by Rosa Brooks, where you know we sort of don't need anything besides the military, because if you want people to go do aid projects, well, the military can do that, and if you want people to go represent the United States diplomatically, well, the military can do that. And there's just sort of nothing that the Pentagon isn't. And so Rosa Brooks makes the observation that the Pentagon is basically Walmart, you know, where you can get everything from an AR-15 to a head of lettuce, depending on what you want. In terms of, you know, the policymaker and sort of governing by polls, you know, I think it's challenging because, you know, it's the language that we use matters. And so if you hear someone say, oh, well, they're strong on defense, well, what does strong on defense actually mean? As I hear the term in political terms, it usually translates to supporting offensive overseas operations almost reflexively. And so if you call for restraint or offshore balancing or diplomatic or other sort of economic approaches, you get painted as weak on defense, which I think is a real shame. And I also think that policymakers generally they suffer from the urge to do something when when constituents want, you know, they want something done, Well, what is it? Well, I'm not sure. Just do something. And so it seems to me that we, the urge to do something is both a frequent but also the worst way to formulate strategy. You know, and if I can just add, you know, I think the United States is really blessed with geography. And, you know, it occurs to me that we're one of the most physically secure countries in the world, in that we've got two enormous moats on our east and on our west. And then to our north and our south, we have weak and friendly neighbors. And yet we perceive ourselves to be insecure. And to me, that, from a political perspective, Claude, which what you're asking about, I think we politically perceive ourselves insecure. And so that, almost above everything else, drives our action in the international system. And if I can use a sort of political science buzzword, it means that we sort of securitize everything. And so I don't know if it's that, you know, the policymaker is at fault or the American people are at fault, but we sort of just tell people, well, as long as the Pentagon, you know, has more money every year, you'll be safer. And, I don't think that that's the case. Let me stop there and invite your comeback.
All right. Thanks. Sal, over to you. Go ahead, Sal.
Sure thing. The classic, I'm hunting and pecking to try to find the right button someplace. Let's pull the thread on that a bit, because you said one of my favorite phrases, which is, we are a nation that really is uniquely blessed from the objective things such as geography and neighbors and the time distance that gives us, that historically we took advantage of for most of our nation's history. And looking at nations and powers through history is many times, for shorthand, we'll break them off into either this is a maritime power, or in the modern context, I think you really need to say maritime aerospace power, or continental land powers. For instance, Russia and both China had traditionally been, because of their geography, continental and land powers. And we look at where we are today, we do have this everybody gets a trophy approach to how we spend our huge defense budget. And you are what you spend. So based upon how we spend our money, do we recognize what our natural geographical strengths, or is it part of a grand strategy, or is it just the military allocation following political inertia back in D.C. disconnected from that?
Well, you know, I think that I'm a bit of a pessimist, actually. And so, you know, recalling your question reminds me of Colin Powell, right? And he says, you know, I don't need to see your strategy. Show me your budget, and I'll tell you what your strategy is. And there are many people more knowledgeable than me on the defense budget. I just sort of look at what we've spent. And I want to know, as a taxpayer, what we've gotten for that money. And the article that you know, we've sort of used, the Make America Strategic Again, when I was writing that, I went to the Simpson Center and also Brown University. And they've both done some costs of war estimates. And, you know, we've spent to fight so-called terrorism, we've spent between $3 and $6 trillion. And my concern is that we just, you know, what have we gotten for that money? And so if I were talking to, you know, if you had Charles Schwab on the phone right now and they said, well, I just spent $3 to $6 trillion, and the financial, you know, and the financial advisor says, well, I'd like to let you know that you just lost that money. You literally got nothing in return for it. We would be upset with that, and we would probably do a zero-based review of our investment strategy. And yet, we've gotten nothing, as far as I can tell, for our spending in, you know, the so-called overseas contingency operations and, you know, all these different pots of money that we raise. And I don't know what we got. And so I guess what I would say is, if we haven't gotten very much for the past, oh, I don't know, 18 years and $6 trillion, maybe we should relook at some of this stuff.
Claude.
David, I'm going to go back to Barbara Tuchman, just because I think you and I are both historians and we like her work. But about 40 years ago, she wrote this, I quote, "Nuclear firepower, because it is too lethal to use, has reduced, not enlarged, the scope of war, with the secondary and rather sinister result is that while unlimited war is out, limited war is in, not as a last resort in the old-fashioned way, but as the regular ongoing policy," unquote. And I wonder, with regard to this quote and your piece in which you talk about the difficulty of the Army to find 80,000 military-aged Americans, some recruiting issues. We see, you, as you brought up in your article, Eric Prince and the possibility of sending mercenary armies. I'm wondering if we're seeing a shift in a public palatability for war as part of that strategy, whether it, because they won't have any skin in the game, whether it's cyber warfare, which, you know, nobody or few people bleed, arguably. I know there'll be people who disagree with that. But in cyber war, there's no blood shed, literally. There may not be American bloodshed in a mercenary war. There may not be some with the advent of unmanned systems. I'm wondering if you think that there will necessarily be a shift in the strategy because war might be more palatable.
Overall, I would say yes. I think the bigger question is, you know, I think palatability and skin in the game are two different things. You know, if you take, for instance, drone warfare, there are very good reasons to use drone warfare. And, you know, in the when I teach, as you may have mentioned, in the I teach my class at Cambridge University in the summer, and students usually come in very angry about drones and how their sort of perception of drones is that drones just sort of get programmed with a bunch of ones and zeros to find guys with long beards and blow them up. And once you sort of explain what drones really do for you, they're like, oh, wow, I didn't quite understand that. So I think, you know, the technology piece is a significant piece, and we should talk more about it. But getting back to the other half of your question, that is to say skin in the game, I mean, this is why I think, you know, when I look at war termination, and this gets back, I think, to maybe Sal's first question about escalation as well. When we look at war termination, how do we do that? Because we don't want to leave anywhere unless it's, quote, conditions-based, right, which is what the Pentagon calls basically everything. So if we left Vietnam, would we have left in 1973 when it was conditions-based? Because, no, our quad slide said, well, you know, is that winning or losing? Oh, that's losing. Oh, well, we're not going to leave. Same thing with Korea, right? We didn't get where we wanted to be. That is to say, a free Korean peninsula. And, you know, to me, I think that the draft would be, or at least a direct payroll tax, would really reconnect Americans more than the technological factor. I'd love to see Americans reconnected with what their government is doing in their name. And if, again, going back to Vietnam, how did we eventually, as a country, decide that enough was enough? It's because it became politically unpopular. Why? Because of activists. Why? Because activists either had to make a choice, show up to a recruiting center, or go to Canada, or go to jail. And there was that impetus to make people you know, live with the consequences of what their government decided to do. And so I don't see it as a nuclear weapons thing. I see it as the sort of, you know, we are, the military is the Praetorian Guard, right? It's the, It's the 1%. And, you know, we respect maybe to the point of idolization of military and of service members, but somehow we've got to reconnect those people to the American people. And so, you know, I'd also love to see a tax that comes out of your paycheck every week, that comes out of every American's paycheck, that would say, you know, this is your Pentagon and VA tax. And so people could see what exactly they were personally spending the money on. And Dave Geo isn't here to judge that or, you know, judge it as good or judge it as bad. I just want people to pay attention to it and get involved. While I'm on the subject, you know, it's the military, of course, would want anything but a draft, right? And so the all volunteer force is definitely the way to go. And I think it's true that it would probably hurt combat readiness and it would hurt the lethality of the armed forces generally. But in my personal view, I think that's a reconnecting the average American to their foreign and military policy in a real and in an immediate way might actually be beneficial, because otherwise I don't see how we would get Americans who sort of generally, well, we support the troops, to reevaluate what's being done in their name. And so I guess if I could just sum that up, I think that a draft would really be a break on overseas adventurism, because that way, as Sal asks, you know, what research has been done? Well, that would tell you real quick if Americans were interested in being a part of that beyond, you know, standing up at baseball games.
Yeah, Dave, that would actually be a great topic for a lengthy research paper, is looking at all of the conflicts the United States has been in, the support from individual members of Congress, and their children who may or may not be involved. For example, Henry Clay in the Mexican-American War, he was an opponent of the war, and yet his son fought and died during that conflict. There have been a number of others as well, when members of Congress had their own children, mostly sons at that point, into the service. Sal, over to you.
Yeah, we kind of put the laser pointer on the American people and on politicians a little bit. I wonder if we could investigate the military side of the house, the classic best military advice. Administrations come and go, political appointees come and go, but oftentimes people in the Pentagon, whether in uniform or civilian, have quite a bit of tenure there and advise consecutive waves of different politicians. And I wanted to look over what are the windmills I like to tilt against. And I wonder if the structure that we've had in place since the height of the Cold War that defines what the military, is that interfering with our ability to get a grand strategy in place, something that the civilian political leadership can understand. I'm speaking specifically of Goldwater Nichols in the COCOM structure, where our COCOMs in some ways act like little geographically oriented proconsuls from Rome, selling their particular areas and interests. And our chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the Joint Chiefs of Staffs in general are man, trip, acquaint, and equip. Is that structure of Goldwater Nickel and the COCOMs, is that part of the problem, or is it a solution waiting to be pushed in the right direction?
It's an excellent question, and I'd like to at least begin to answer it by telling a little C story about the sort of proconsuls. And I was at a joint war game in my reserve capacity a couple of years ago up at the Naval War College, and we were fighting an enemy that I won't name, and we were, I don't know, call it, you know, 4 or 5 days into the exercise, but that number of days, you know, is supposed to represent several weeks, you know, in sort of, you know, the exercise timeline. And so, you know, every morning and afternoon, you know, well, Admiral, you know, this is what's going on. You know, here's what they sunk. Here's what we sunk. Here's what they did. Here's what we did. And it, you know, it just sort of dawned on me that the entire exercise was taking place in a specific geographic combatant commander's territory. And that if I were the adversary country, I, you know, just bringing in the cyber dimension for a second, I would say, well, geez, it's no fun fighting America at sea, right? That's not a fun thing to do. And so in order to turn this off and make the Americans go away, why wouldn't I just, shut down some of the U.S. critical national infrastructure? Why wouldn't I shut down Wall Street and hurt the American GDP? Why wouldn't I open up some dams in the United States and let some flooding occur? How can I possibly inflict pain on the American people in order to get them to turn their military off? And then it dawned on me that they probably very well could do that, and the whole exercise therefore wasn't really worth very much, because I think that we had the wrong people at the table. And so I wonder, to kind of put the question back on you, is it generals and admirals, or is it, you know, who's really going to be calling? And it doesn't matter if it's the Trump administration or some other administration. Who's going to be calling the White House, and whose phone calls are going to be taken at the White House? Or even in the Pentagon? Would it be the proconsul, that is to say, the combatant commander and his or her staff, or is it, Jamie Dimon, or some banking executive, or Jeff Bezos, or Elon Musk, or people that have enormous multi-billion dollar businesses that are being hurt because Americans and some other adversary are shooting at each other over an enormous swath of the globe. And so, to me, I wondered if we had the wrong people at the table. So that's just to kind of set the stage, I think, for the question. And then the only other thing I really wanted to add was that I think that especially the 3- and 4-star general officers do have a duty to give their best military advice, which I know that they take seriously. But what happens when the best military advice turns out to be, this isn't worth it, and I can't do what you've asked me to do with the resources that I have in hand, right? So, you know, there was a great Duffel Blog article about the next commander in Afghanistan, which was, the 11th, the 15th, the 17th, you know, going back to Tommy Franks. And the author of the Duffel Blog article suggested that it was a little bit like the Indy 500, where every so often they turn a corner, and then they turn a corner, and then they turn a corner. And, of course, they're just going in circles. And I wonder if general officers, I'm sure they wouldn't do this in public, because we have the civilian control of the military that the military takes very seriously. But in private, are they saying, look, you know, I'm honored that you've selected me to be the CENTCOM commander or the ISAF commander or the MNFI commander, but truthfully, sir, this can't be done what you're asking. And I'll go back to Clausewitz again, who reminds us that once the amount of blood and treasure expended exceeds the value of an object, you have to give up the object. And so we've got, let's use Afghanistan as an example. Have we expended more blood and treasure rebuilding Afghanistan than is worth from a core national security perspective? And if the answer is yes, well, then a modern general officer, I think, owes it to the National Command Authority to quote the Prussian general officer and let them say, you know what, this can't actually be done. And I don't usually hear that a lot. I usually hear sort of, you know, yes, sir, we'll figure out how to make it happen. And of course, the, you know, whatever issue it is, just perpetuates.
Claude.
You know, in reading the right to the end of your piece, David, you know, I was struck. I was waiting for that what's next. And I hope you write a second article, because my next question deals with this. Let's wave the magic wand, and you're the National Security Advisor, and President Salamander asks you this question. What are America's core interests? What are America's core interests and international challenges, and how should strategy reflect that?
Right. You know, I think, you know, I ask this of my cadets every so often. I don't want to say what we should do as a people, other than, you know, we really need to take this seriously, switch autopilot off, and, you know, and re-engage the blob to have a little bit more dynamic discussion about who are we and what do we want to do in the world. But I guess, you know, for me personally, when I look through my own misbegotten youth and then my own writing, I look at how I changed when I became a parent. And so I think my litmus test for what is an American core national security interest, before I was a dad, I would say, oh, well, it's something that's worth my life. The problem is that there's a lot of, you know, I don't know, I mean, maybe teaching at West Point, you sort of see it a lot, but there's a lot of young people that want to, you know, giddy up and get in the game. So my new litmus test that I would ask Americans would be, what war or what cause or what interest is worth laying down your child's life for? And whatever that answer is, that's an American core national interest. And I hope that really narrows the playing field for people. Whatever answer it is, if they answer Ukraine, well, if enough Americans answer Ukraine, okay. If they answer the defense of Taiwan, well, then you know, I guess we're gonna, you know, need a bigger Seventh Fleet. But enough Americans need to be ready to make those sacrifices. And I guess, you know, once I've become a dad, right, that's a really hard question to answer. And so, you know, when I sort of play, when I'm doing writing, or I see other people that are sort of, I don't know, cavalier with lives, you know, I guess I would offer two things. The first one is that my commute takes me by the West Point Cemetery. And nothing sharpens your focus than going through, you know, driving through a cemetery where people have potentially lost their lives in overseas service. And then as a history professor, I go into the history department, and we have a little memorial poster to all of the history majors who've died since 9/11. And I look at them. And then even when I go get my coffee at Starbucks, there's a picture of a young first lieutenant, West Point grad, and she used to like to go to the Starbucks, and she lost her life in Afghanistan. And so I want the immediacy of that sacrifice to permeate our national, our strategic conversation, even if it's only between elites. I want us to do it with recognition of what the real costs of war are. I think we owe it to these people. If I were given my druthers, you know, getting back to the political question, every time we declare war or authorize military force, because we've stopped declaring war since 1942, but every time we do that, I'd love for us to do it at the tomb of the unknown soldier. I mean Congress. And every time we do it, I think we ought to do it in the presence of Gold Star families to help us understand the gravity of what's going on. And that's really what sort of made me cranky about the initial, why I decided to write the piece when I did. Because I think, getting back to your question, Claude, of, you know, what does the strategy look like? Well, let's figure out what's worth it first and what do we want. And then once we figure out what we want, we can figure out what are the available resources and who's going to be involved in that equation. But we have to know what's a U.S. core national interest. And when we start saying that everything is a U.S. core national interest, well, then nothing is. And that's when we start to get confused.
That's a great answer, David. And, as you were talking about that, I was thinking about the last few pages of a book by James Webb, Naval Academy grad, Marine, former Secretary of the Navy, former Senator. The book is called Something to Die For. And I would encourage anyone to read that book and especially those last few pages. And it goes exactly to what David just talked about. So.
Yeah, Something to Die For. That's a great lead in to quick hour, maybe our last question. But I wanted to bring you over because when I think about grant strategy and what we're doing right now, I've always had a feeling that inertia has no small part of it. And we, and a lot of the obligations or entanglements, as you mentioned in your article, involve our allies and friends. And in the beginning of our conversation and in the article, use the example of Poland, putting American forces in Poland, which anybody with access to a decent map knows Poland lies between Germany and Russia. So if Russia is the threat, let's talk about our NATO friend. What is between Russia and Poland, then what? That's Germany. Germany, Belgium, Czech Republic, Slovakia, just to name a few, whereas Poland seems to be making a good effort for her national defense. Our allies don't. And like hopefully we've all learned in our lives, you can't make somebody love you. Can you desire and respect another nation's sovereignty and freedom more than they do? And as part of an assessment of our grand strategy, if we need to break it down and do it from a baseline zero, do we also need to look at some of the assumptions that we've had for decades may not apply simply on the basis of who are our friends, who are our allies, and do they care as much as we do? And if not, why do we do?
Right. I would point you to an excellent essay by Gil Barndaller in The National Interest about 2 weeks ago, where it's called something like NATO is 70 and it should retire. And he makes a very compelling case for why NATO might have been okay for stability in the Cold War. But actually, moving Russia's strategic depth, if we just put our Russia hat on for a second, the reason why they were saved from Napoleon and then from Hitler was because they had strategic depth. We have strategic depth in water, which is wonderful. They don't have that. And so after the Cold War was over, we agreed that we would not move NATO up to their doorstep. And of course, we then just kept marching and marching and marching. And so they no longer have the strategic depth that they feel that they need that saved them both in 1812 and again in the early 1940s. And I think that we do a bad job. We do a disservice, I think, to the American people when we conflate U.S. national security with the national security of our allies. They're not the same thing. And that doesn't mean allies are good or bad or worth it or not worth it. It just means that they're separate questions. And I think getting to your NATO point, we spend a lot of time with either, NATO yes or NATO no. And the NATO yes school seems to think that we need to continue to subsidize the defense of Europe. And the NATO no people think that we just need to, sort of pull the plug on it. And I'd like to offer a middle ground, which is that we scale back our commitment to NATO based on our population, based on our risk, and based on our GDP, and then based on our assessment of the threat. And so if the European Union has 520 million people and the United States has 320 million people, well, why is the U.S. Why is the U.S. shouldering that load, especially because we're the farthest from it? That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. That's not to say we shouldn't be a part of it. That's not to say that allies and common defense isn't a good thing. The question is just why can't we rebalance that a little bit? And when I was in Riga, Latvia last summer on vacation, and I, you know, just being a sort of pseudo historian / political scientist, I went to every local I could find, and I, you know, I chatted them up, and I said, "What do you think of the Russians? Do you think the Russians are, you know, are they going to invade the Baltics?" And you know, and everybody looked at me in Riga like I was insane, like I was, you know, that it was the early 1940s, and they said, "Absolutely not. We are not afraid of the Russians." And whether that's because they know that there's such thing as NATO, or I didn't understand why, but we, you know, so many miles away, think that Russia is this terrible threat, when in actuality they only have about 120 million people. Their indicators are terrible in terms of demography and economics. Their GDP is smaller than Italy's. And granted, they have nukes, but getting back to Claude's point, no one's using those anymore. So, you know, what are we so scared of? And it reminds me a little bit, this is the last Clausewitz thing, I promise, but it's one of my favorite quotes. He says, "One country may support another's cause, but it will never take it so seriously as it takes its own." And if I could just sort of reformulate that or update that for NATO, I think what he's telling us today is that you can't care more about another country than it cares about its own security. So if the Germans feel comfortable, as they famously did an exercise with painted broomsticks because they didn't have the right weapons, you know, and if that's how secure they feel, well, then maybe we should take a lesson from that, because ultimately they're the ones right after Poland who are going to bear that brunt. So it does seem to me, I think, Sal, getting back to your question, that we can't care more about European security, and we can't spend more on it than the Europeans themselves do, because, you know, getting back to the purpose of my article and the domestic support question, that's not fair to the American people.
And on that note, David, it has been a great hour. Really appreciate you taking time this afternoon to join us. And for the listener, if they wanted to keep track of your work and read what you've been putting forward, where's a good place for them to keep an eye out for you? And what are you working on right now we can look forward to?
Oh, gracious. I don't tweet. I think that would be like giving my 5-year-old an Uzi, so I don't do that. but I do have all of my my stuff, almost all of my stuff, on LinkedIn, so they can check out my profile, see what I've done. The Army Cyber Institute has a page that I try to keep up with my writing. I've been writing recently about what I'm calling hybrid intelligence, which I've been looking at the Russian use of effective hacking and cyber operations, which we saw in the 2016 election, but joining that with their classic use of human intelligence and sort of classic human tradecraft. And when they put those two things together, as they did in the 2016 election, where you've got, you know, hacking and phishing and John Podesta, but then classic stuff, you know, the use of useful fools, with everybody from George Papadopoulos to Carter Page to Roger Stone to WikiLeaks to General Flynn, I'm sad to say. When you put that all together, I think it's very powerful, the joining the old with the new. And so doing some work on that. And also my other projects deal with mass leaking. and how do we attempt to understand the Edward Snowdens and the Bradley, now Chelsea Mannings of the world, and how do we deal as an intelligence community in particular with mass leaking when we seem to lose the strategic narrative that we're no longer the good guys because our national security secrets and our intelligence community secrets are laid bare on places like WikiLeaks or other news organizations. And so I think we have a real challenge facing us on both of these fronts, and technology and the power of digital networks and information operations or information warfare. I think that this is all sort of a witch's brew that I'm writing quite a lot about and really enjoying researching.
Well, perfect. And thank you very much for coming on. And Claude, I think we'll keep you as a guest host. It's been a pleasure having you on, doing as best you can to substitute for Eagle One.
Happy to, Sal. Thanks for having me. And thanks, David.
Thank you both.
And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. Until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy day. Cheers.
Piccadilly.